Thank you. We are lucky. We have half an hour of discussion in front of us. Now, would one of you already react to what he heard from the other panelists? If you don't, I can. Oh, well, they have.
Now just a very quick question, may I?
Go ahead, Jean-Paul.
Yeah, very quick question. Did you map the distribution of the autism? Did you map the distribution of the case? It's regarding the environment.
No. We did ourselves nothing in mapping this. The CDC is following the map this very well. And there's also for the different federal states maps available from the website of CDC.
Oh, okay, good, thank you.
Any other reaction? Michel Kazachkin?
Yeah, a quick reaction on after several of the talks, but particularly the one from our colleagues from Singapore. I think this shows how much health at the local, national level is now interlinked with health at the regional and global level. So I think I see this interesting trend where a minister of health, whose primary job is somehow to protect the health of the citizens of his country, is now also someone who has to positively work on contributing to global health because of that close interaction between the two. Just as, you know, a diplomat would in the old times be basically there to protect the interests of his nation, but now he's both, it is most important for the diplomat to protect the interests of his nation, but also to build a better global world. So that intricacy between national level and global level, to me, is a key feature of health and science and diplomacy in the 21st century.
Thank you.
Just
I already quick, have...
Just a quick comment.
Go ahead.
To add on to what our colleague had mentioned. I think it is really important that, you know, our health agencies and our border security agencies work with the global community, because I think Singapore is a very big travel hub. So if you heard what Michelle mentioned earlier about how SARS spread from Hong Kong to Singapore, it was just one traveler infecting 200 over people and caused an epidemic in the country. So being a travel hub, you are not isolated from or delayed from any kind of emerging infections that may arrive in the country.
There are questions, lady in the front, and then two others afterwards.
Hello, everyone. My name is Hyatt Cindy. And I think I relate to most of you here in the panel. I'm my first degree in pharmacology, and I did my PhD in finding the side effect of atrazine to the free radical to the brain, and my profession to design low, affordable, low-cost diagnostic tool, especially to the developing world. So I have a question, and I do agree with Wilson. I hope I can call you by your first name, but Wilson, health, and Michael, health is definitely affecting policy, affecting governments, economy. And my question is, first question, why now we lack, most of the research now is towards, you know, very competitive type of technology, as I mentioned to me today and earlier in my talk. But well-being, health, psychological health, it's being really pushed aside, which is really we need to have a more attention to this, that. So I just want to know why. Is it because of economy? Maybe you can tell me your reason, because you are, you know, expert in the field more than I when I read. And my other question is, I think we lack one area of research. I think I do. Today I talk about robot is going to take us by storm, but I think another technology is going to take us by storm is biochip. Because until now, if we don't understand the makeup of our own body, we cannot design better drugs, we cannot find a cure for diseases. And we've been also neglecting that part because we find it, you know, biosensor, biotechnology is a long road, and also it's not a good, perfect marriage between biology and transducers. But I think with the, think of the box, how we can find affordable technology, that will be also the way to go forward. But of course, as being now, as a pharmacology, you know, pharmaceutical company, sometime, well, most of the time prevent that type of research because at the end of the day, they're looking for profit. So I cannot find one single pharmaceutical company from the start linking R&D to affordable health care, because what they do toward the community, what is left over after they make so much money, go to research, but leftovers, but not dedicated from the beginning. Because when dedicated from the beginning, you will have your CEO, your scientist, everything, the policy toward to find affordable, low-cost healthcare to everyone in the world. So healthcare should be accessible, affordable to every single human being. It has the right to be accessed to monitoring, to diagnose, and to treatment. So I hope that you can comment.
Okay, I think Michel Kazaskin, and then Georgi, you all to answer. Mr. Compton.
You had a number of statements there, and I think it addresses several of us along the panel. Regarding your first question about why we allocate resources in certain directions, I would point out that for the field that I represent, the addiction field, we have been sorely underrepresented in healthcare research and in public health implementation. Most of the focus in the addiction field has been on law enforcement. And so one of our major emphases right now that we're in collaboration with Dr. Kajatkin and others is to try to bring a health perspective into the addiction area. So that instead of purely relying on law enforcement, we rely on the best of both. So combine public health and public safety approaches rather than the pure public safety that has been the major policy approach globally. But I'd be curious what our pharmaceutical company representative had to say about your last comment, which were a little bit...
Yeah, well, I purposely didn't say anything about patents because that makes things awfully complicated. But the world is complicated in that sense. So when talking about patents, the pharmaceutical companies invest, as I said, $1 to $2 billion of dollars into one new chemical entity. Then there is a patent term during which they have an exclusive right to market this product because of the patents. And this is, at the end, 25 years. All in all, it's 25 years. After the patent expires, then it can come accessible and affordable for all of the people because the price drop is driven by the many competitors. All the companies can come because there is not a patent which is covering the drug. So after 25 years, so this is an additional 25 years. So if we start a research today, there will be a 25 years of lap until it can get easily accessible for many people. So the price drop is like from 100 to 1. One box of monthly supply of a drug is 100 when it's covered by a patent, and then it gets to $1 or euro per month. This is an additional factor which I didn't talk about because it's quite, it's quite complicated.
Dr. Kazashkin?
Go ahead.
I just want to clarify the comments that the chip that we talk about is not an immunoassay chip. It is a direct microorganism detection chip that is based on PCR and microarray. So it is not an immunoassay that's based on antibody testing, which I agree with you totally. It would not be good for early detection. It will have a lot of insensitivities.
Just a quick comment to say to thank you. I think your point is well taken and very relevant. I believe the situation will be untenable. There is a fundamental contradiction between what countries have signed in terms of human rights, including the right to access to health, and what countries have signed within the trade frame. We have been living this as a tension. But the deepest now is the gap between the rich that can access some of the medicines and the poor that cannot access them, the more we're in this contradiction. And I'm just taking my UN hat here to say that the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, will announce this month that he is asking a high-level panel, that's the way the UN do it, of independent high-level people, to reflect on this and bring that issue of the fundamental contradiction between trade and human rights in terms of access to the global public goods, that is access to health, to bring that to the General Assembly of the UN. So one day or another, that system will crack and we'll have to find solutions.
A question by the lady on the second row.
My name is Helen Robinson. I'm from the Nossal Institute for Global Health in Australia. And I guess my observation, I guess, a very complex panel with a great diversity of views, but I'm rather surprised that I guess the biggest area that I would suggest, and I don't think I would be alone, of policy failure in the area of health is in the area of non-communicable disease, where we've seen, a policy failure to take on the very issues that influence those diseases and premature death, particularly in low and middle income countries, the kinds of policy issues that national governments should be picking up on that are outside the health system, that impact largely on the budgets of health systems because of failure to control things that lead to premature obesity. One of the panel members mentioned tobacco use and so on, but alcohol, poor physical, poor diet, and lack of physical activity, that I think the jury is certainly in terms of the policy failure in that area to take on some things that are governed by trade agreements as well, with the flow of food and overnutrition. And I guess my observation is, after listening to the panel, that it's a very, very complex agenda of competing interests. But I guess I'm a little bit surprised that none of the speakers are thinking about the policy failure in the area of non-communicable diseases. Maybe some would care to pass a comment.
Sorry, I thought I sort of somehow alluded to that by saying that many of the areas that impact on health, many of the decisions that impact on health are actually taken outside the health field, be it on climate, be it on food, be it... So decisions are taken by other ministries, or even by boards of companies, yes, if you think of toxic food. So that means that the health ministry, the health is should move from its current position of a technical ministry focused on care to grow to something much bigger, societal, and capable of embracing all the dimensions which you meant. I fully agree with your comment.
Certainly, my presentation focused on non-communicable diseases, but only one component of them. And I do think those are underrepresented in healthcare policy, and that's why I agree with you to try to draw attention to them. As we've had tremendous success in some of our earlier contributors to mortality, we need to look at the next generation of diseases that are limiting lifespan and increasing morbidity everywhere.
After what you said, Dr. Kazachkin, I'd like to ask make a very naive comment. Do you think our political people are really aware of what you say? I mean, with what you suggest, one would have to have presidents and prime ministers or the equivalent who really know something about health and science. And in many countries, it's not the case. Or do you think it will change? You think that these people, because health is such an important topic and it can, well, maybe overthrow some governments, maybe, they will change. They will understand that it's not only science and technical problems.
Well, certainly in most countries of the world, health is still confined to an area that is very much looked as being an expert or technical area, and also looked at as being the Ministry of Health, as being a ministry that is a ministry of expenditure. Hmm. So we try to cut on expenses, and it's not looked at as a ministry of investment. And that shift hasn't occurred. But when there is a huge pressure from the outside, let's say an Ebola outbreak, let's say an AIDS epidemic, then health goes directly to the Prime Minister or to the President. We've seen that with the AIDS epidemic and the national AIDS councils that were formed across Africa or the world that were directly under the authority of the President. So I think we're still far from the picture you were bringing, but I think we need to move health from the idea of it being just an expenditure to it being an intelligent societal investment.
Jean-Paul González, you wanted to react.
Yeah, just one word in the side of science and not inside of policy. I mean, we develop already the concept of emerging non-communicable disease, which is a concept very important that we are witnessing the emergence of this non-communicable disease. And I'm turning to my colleague over there, the pandemic of autism. I mean, this is something extremely new and extremely important for us to take into account in terms of science. Then we have to convey the message to the policy and to the medical diplomacy. But that's another dimension. And it depends on the country, it depends on the politics, it depends on the region, it depends on the culture. But what I want just to make the point here, I mean, we are really aware of this non-communicable disease, which are very important. We are now designing this framework of study of emerging non-communicable disease. A lot of things are done in human genetics also, which is another world. So all these things are part of the science, are part of the health, and we have to, it's a global, really, concern for the scientists working on health. Thank you.
There's a question at the... There are plenty of questions now. Where are you? You're here.
Good afternoon. Casimiro Vizzini from the UNESCO Natural Science Sector. I wanted to point your attention and ask for your opinion about the relationship between science and communication, especially talking about health. During the Ebola crisis, there was a lot of misinformation and people were starting to be superstitious like in the Middle Age. If we mention chemistry to people, they will think about toxicity and that's it. If we mention genetics, they will think about GMO and how bad they are for their health. So where's the problem? Where is the problem? Is the journalism, we know, sometimes sensationalism pays more than good quality information. But from the other side, I think the responsibility is also on the scientist side in the not very good skills in communication with the press. So journalists and scientists, it's a problem nowadays, in my opinion.
Anybody want to react? As a journalist, well, you know, nothing to say. We all know that. That's the problem. And on the internet, you find whatever you want to find. If you like horror stories, you find them. If you want hooray stories, you find them also. So that's it. We have to do with that. But the scientists, I think they're improving, in fact, you know. Look, they're trying to express things. It was not bad, was it? Even if it was very, very loaded.
I do think in a very practical sense, if we expect support from our policymakers and our legislators, we better be able to communicate the importance and value of our work so that it is incumbent on the scientific community to develop those skills. And they are skills that can be developed. Not every scientist is going to be a good public presenter, and I don't expect that. But we can certainly find those who are good and put them out front.
Thank you,
Jean-Paul González. And then there's a question at the back. You have the microphone.
Very quickly, as a scientist and as a researcher, one of our mission when we become senior scientists is communicate. Communicate with the student, number one, and communicate with the partners, and communicate outside with the social public society. So this is our mission. This is a mission of the senior scientists to communicate. And we are doing this. I mean, we are here for that also. So I think it's the communication, it's open. It's open, it's there. Now the journals, I mean, when you write a paper in Nature or in Science, I mean, the editor said we need an abstract to be understandable by everybody. So this is not, the content can be complex and very specific, but the presentation needs to be read by everybody, including social science for a scientific paper or for a fundamental paper, etc. So the communication are there. We can enhance this. We can make it better, but they are there, yes. Thank you.
We're left with 5 minutes, so quick questions, yeah. Quick answers.
Thank you.
And there are two or one microphone.
Okay. Thank you, Dominic. Aidan Gilligan, yeah. From SciComm, Making Sense of Science. I have one question for Professor Kazatchkin and a question for Thomas Hartung. Professor Kazatchkin, with your Global Fund hat on, and you led the creation of one of the biggest funds in the world before the Bill Gates Foundation took over, essentially, would you be worried at this conference that so many people are saying that money is going to leave health through the development funds and go into the climate mitigation funds? And is there leadership in the health community to kind of argue against this? And the second question is to Thomas Hartung. It strikes me, looking at the panel, that you see such wonderful leadership in America in the health areas that kill us the most, drugs, alcohol, tobacco. You look at NIDA and the wonderful work that Professor Compton mentioned. But in the European Union, we haven't got a single health institution. You get differences of opinion between the French and the British on the basics of health. So is there anybody in your world advocating that, say, the chemist should talk to the toxicologist, or that there would be a European Institute for, say, toxicology? I mean, is there nobody in the health community worried about this lack of common sense?
Thank you, Aidan. On your first question, yes, I am concerned that funding for global health is decreasing. I wouldn't say funding for health in general globally is decreasing, but funding for global health. And that comes in a climate as a sort of paradox. The more we're globalizing, the more the world is globalizing. At the same time these days, the more it is fragmenting somehow into regions, into nationalism, into individualism. And that has led to much less interest these days in the 21st century to what people called global public goods. So that very that sort of driving force of the notion of global public goods that we can only achieve through a common collective effort of the global world, we don't speak so much about it now. Even on global health issues, let's say HIV/AIDS, which is my area, but it's true for tuberculosis, it's true for a number of other global issues, they tend to be now picked up and dealt with at the regional level because of specific epidemiological features, but also because funding is so much linked to the politics, and the politics of multilateralism are losing ground. So these, I mean, very briefly, are some of the contextual reasons I see why that funding for global health is currently decreasing. And yes, I am worried, because I don't think global should be the sum of regional. I think global should remain global.
Aidan, you're hinting to something very important. I've experienced now from both sides of the Atlantic, worked in both systems, and clearly, Europe has become a pacemaker of new legislation, and we have a gridlock in the US. But at the same time, in the execution side, the US agencies have shown enormous initiatives in modernizing the tools and changing the paradigms, while we have a situation where in Europe there's no coordination, there's no strategic development, there's only execution of these legislations. And that's why I'm very sympathetic with the idea of a European Safety Sciences Institute, something which is coordinating the strategies and is on same eye level to the US initiatives and can actually help modernize the tools. Because the key message of my presentation was the current tools are not good enough to do actual health control. They're too costly, they're not predictive for humans, and we need to do something better. And we need to help regulators to get these tools into their hands. And that's where coordination is important. Thanks.
Questions allowed?
Go ahead. Do you have a microphone?
I'm fairly loud. I can speak loud enough. It's more of a comment. I'm really, this is a fantastic conversation. It's great that global
Well, that will be the last point and the last remark. And I want to thank now all the panelists. I hope you had time to express yourself, and maybe some other people will ask you questions now, because it's nearly 4 o'clock. Thank you very much for your attention.